Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, a cup of coffee-flavored holy water, and a very special union member with me today to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Our guest today is a fellow podcaster, streamer, and game writer, and game designer, Jason Hobbs. Welcome to the show, Jason. It's glad to have you on here.
Hey, Jason. Thank you so much for having me. I've been hearing a lot about plumbing and plunging toilets recently, so I am very, very appreciative and thankful to be here. Thank you.
Well, the union is open to everyone, and particularly you, because you're one of the people that got me kind of into the like playing online. You know, you're one of the first people I ever played online with. You know, you invited me into your Kalmata, legendary Kalmata. I listened to your podcast. I felt like a rock star being able to come on and play with you. So,
yeah, I've heard you talk about your Kalmata experience and how terrible it was on a couple of different podcasts.
I don't think I said it was terrible.
It wasn't your style.
Yeah, I still haven't figured out how to make OSC work. I really want to. I really, really do. I've always felt as if somehow I'm a lesser player because I'm not able to like roll with that style of game. And it's kind of taken me a little while to reconcile that, hey, you know what? We all have different play styles. We all have different things that we enjoy, and there shouldn't be any shame in, you know, choosing a different path from maybe what the mainstream is.
There's absolutely no shame in that. And I think a lot of it has to do with your point of view and why you are gaming. Like for you, you're not a zero to hero guy. I want to do heroic stuff. And OSE is not that game. OSE is not about the characters. It's about what happens or the setting until it becomes about the characters. But you don't really know who the protagonists are until they become the protagonists. And still then, it's like a Game of Thrones versus Brandon Sanderson, where you already know who the main heroes are, and or Wheel of Time, right? You already know Rand and all the dudes from the Two Rivers. These guys are what the story's about. This is their adventuring group, and we're just going to see what happens. Well, that's not what OSE or really Kalmata or any of those games about. That's more like, hey, this is Death Island, and we don't know who the main people are until they become the main people. And even then, they could still die. There's no character plot armor for any of them. So that's my whole concept about what the differences are between the games. And I like both styles because you also played in my in a Low Fantasy Gaming actual campaign where you guys were the heroes and the story kind of went around your characters. And I think it's definitely a different style of play. And I love both of them. So
I agree. I really loved the Low Fantasy game. That campaign that you were running was really, really fun and really interesting. There was, you know, a really good combination of mystery, but also, you know, we had a lot of action, a lot of fighting and stuff like that, which is something that I really appreciate. I think Steve of Pickpocket Press really, really nailed it when he put that one together.
I'm a huge fan of Low Fantasy Gaming. I've been a massive proponent of it, running it online, and he calls me the GM overlord because I think I ran more sessions of Low Fantasy Gaming than he has. And he wrote the game.
Did he send you an award? Like, did you get a medal?
No, he used to send me core books of Low Fantasy Gaming hardcovers to give out at convention games when I would run them. He also sent me like one of those big retractable banners so I could set it up at the table and really make try and get more players involved. That's what made DCC what it is people were running it at cons. And so that's what I was trying to do with Low Fantasy Gaming. I'm not sure we ever got there, but you know, he has a second edition now, and I think it's even bigger than the first. So,
yeah, I feel like he's really done something special. I feel like he's really cultivated his own niche in the hobby. I mean, if you look at his Discord, it's just, it's rocking in there.
It is, just like we were talking about earlier before we got on the mics here, the difference in how that community has changed from when I was always running games, when Low Fantasy Gaming, not when it first came out, because it's been around for a long time, actually. But when Low Fantasy Gaming Deluxe came out, I was in that Discord and there was a core group of people. But now there's, you know, 10 times that number, and they're way younger and have different interests for sure.
It's interesting. So just to step back for a minute, I do have listeners that probably aren't aware of your legacy. Can you just give us a brief intro into like how you got into gaming and kind of who you are, and, you know, let us know who is Mr. Hobbs and where is the gamerhood?
All right. So I would say a long time ago in the misty era of the late 70s, I spent a lot of time at my grandmother's house, and there were, by the end of that age group or that generation, there were 33 grandchildren. So it's a pretty big family, but only, every weekend, not every weekend, but for the summers, I would stay there, and right across the yard was her daughter, my cousins. And there were a few of them. And one time, Glenda, my older, cousin, had a boyfriend, and he came with a space opera and a Dungeons and Dragons set, which was Holmes. So it was the Holmes box set with the chromatic blue dragon box on it. And we started playing, and I fell in love with that whole idea. I was probably 8 years old. Obviously, I don't have the greatest memories of it, but the ones I do have been quite significant. And I think even from the start, I was way more interested than anybody else was. But people, I mean, we played for years, and there was a huge age difference from the players, right? So I'm 8 years old, and maybe Terry, the guy who brought it, might have been like in his 20s. So pretty big gap. And I would say even when they weren't there, my half-brother and I were always at my grandma's house, even when maybe they were gone doing stuff, because they're older, right? So they're doing old people stuff. I would just make up the stories, and we would make up our own system, flipping pennies or pieces of paper and draw, because at that point in that box set they didn't even have dice. They just had the chits that you would pull out.
Oh, interesting.
We didn't have the chits that were, they were at the house. So then we would write the numbers on a piece of paper and throw them in a hat. Oh, 19. Yeah, buddy. Anyway, you know, that's what, and it was just mostly me and him, or a couple other cousins also lived within a few blocks. They might come over. And to me, that was like the thing that I loved more than anything in the game. And I would say I kind of kept that for a long time. And there's no one in my family now from those early days that are more involved in tabletop role playing than I am, obviously, because in the early 2000 era, by then I had switched out from Dungeons and Dragons. This would have been second edition before third edition came out, and found Hero System, and really loved the idea of the Hero System, where you could play champions, fantasy, you could play whatever. I never played GURPS really, but I know most people either played Hero or they played GURPS, because the systems kind of have the same backbone. They're just slightly different point of views or angles that they're coming from. Loved Hero System. I played in this game that had been around for like 15 or 20 years, that they were making their own universe of hero superheroes. And it would have some people from all the different, you know, Marvel, DC, made up, all these different things. And it was this long, there were multiple campaigns with multiple superhero groups. And I was just fascinated with running superheroes, because I never really had before. We had Marvel superheroes, Phase Rip, back in the day, but we didn't really make our own characters. That system wasn't great for it, for that at my age. So champions. And then when third edition came out, I wanted to show all my hero buddies what D&D was all about. Hated it. So didn't do that. Back to champions again, skip fourth edition. And then in the more 2010-ish, 2013, that's when I started hearing about the OSR and the concept of that. Went to my first con with one of my good buddies, Adam Miskevich, who started one of the first role-playing game podcasts that I had ever heard of, called Drink, Spin, Run. And him, me, and his wife all met up, and we met up. This is right when DCC was coming out. And so we spent the weekend at a GaryCon 3, I think, We're on GaryCon 17 now, I think. I don't know. And we played a ton of DCC and just hung out and got to meet all these awesome people like Doug and Joseph and Brendan LaSalle and Michael Curtis, all the DCC people in the very, very early era. I sat with Joseph Goodman for hours and just talked to him about it. He doesn't really hang out with the plebes anymore that I'm aware of, but it was pretty awesome anyway. And then I got into this going to cons, and I'm lucky enough to live in Northern Illinois, which is very close to Gamehole Con in Madison and GaryCon. So they're all both, you know, an hour and a half from me max. So I could drive back and forth if I wanted to, but these are great conventions. They're not as big as Gen Con or Origins, but they're also kind of small enough that everyone sort of hangs out in the same area and you get to see everyone. You don't always meet everyone, but you get to see everyone. And so that led me to meet Sean P. Kelly, who had started his own podcast called Gaming and BS with his buddy Brett Blazinski. And I would listen to that, and I definitely thought I could do better than that. Which is funny because Sean is on a live stream on his YouTube right now. But I love Sean and Brett. And I don't think I did it better. I think I just did it different. And it was more, theirs was any gaming, basically. But most of the people I knew and the things I was most interested in was kind of old school D&D and the OSR. And so I had a show called Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. And we did interviews with, like you've done interviews with some of the guys since then, but I don't know what I had, some 75 episodes or something of Hobbs and Friends. It was awesome. It was fantastic. I always say that I'm going to get another episode going. I even have like lists of guests. Like I could probably have 50 guests. I still have the list. And if I reached out to them, guaranteed they would be on. I was very surprised on the amount of people who knew who I was just by my voice. Cause there was no YouTube. I was at North Texas one year, pretty early 2016, 2017, probably right after the show was starting to go around. I never knew what any of my numbers were because I was in a podcasting network and a guy took care of all that. All I did is set up the interviews, did the shows, and then sent off the audio, and they did everything else, which I liked because I'm better at talking than working anyway. So, and from there, it kind of came into a situation where I was thought maybe I'd already said most of the things I wanted to say. I also had another show called Random Screed, which was really mostly a personal journal. I had found this Anchor app from another guy named Eric Frankhouse, who was buddies with Sean and was when I was around them at cons, or it's Madison, it's only an hour away, so sometimes I would see them. And he would talk about this Anchor app, and it's the future of podcasting. And Sean was like, oh, you don't get to keep your stuff. What if it changes? What's going to happen to the podcast? All these things that he foretold years before it actually happened. And so I'm like, oh, I drive all day, every day as a job. And that gives me, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day that I can talk into a phone if I want to. And so I thought it would be a good way to talk. My whole idea is my first few episodes were me talking about other podcasts. And instead of writing in or calling in, because people weren't calling into shows really back then, you'd send emails. I wanted to talk about the shows, and then I would tell, hey, Sean, I just did a critique, or I have a bunch of questions, talked about your show, listen to it, and then you can call me, and then I can play it, and we can talk about it. I really kind of thought it was blogging was big, but it was still petering out some. And I was like, this will be the new blogging, where instead of you go read their blog, put comments and do your own blog about their blog. And then it spread out across, you know, 20 people at first, maybe a dozen people, and then 20, and then 50, and then 100. Maybe this with the Anchor app, it's so easy to do a show. Maybe this could be the future of blogging. And at that point, you could still bring in music because it was attached not to Spotify, but to one of the other platforms where music was held. So you could put music in, you could do whatever. And some of the Anchor apps were just people like being a DJ and saying, all right, what we got up next, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, let's go, or whatever. That's what Anchor was. And in my early Random Screed episodes, you would hear that. The whole name of Random Screed came from a conversation I had at North Texas with Chris Kutelik, who is part of the Hydra Collective. He did Slumberinger Assigned Dunes, I think, is probably what he's most popular for, if you've ever heard of it. He used to have a blog that was called The Hill Cantons, which was very, very popular. And we were talking about him, like, yeah, I think I want to do this show where I'm never going to say what my name is. All I'm going to do is complain about all the podcasts and just get all this stuff fired up and get people. And I'm going to call it Random Screed. And then people will call in and they won't know who I am, but they'll try to figure it out. It was just like that one guy who used to do he would do reviews of gaming stuff, but as like a made up person. I don't know, like he thinks he's Macho Man Randy Savage, and all he's doing is typing like a madman and would just say terrible things about stuff. I'm not talking about Bryce, who also says terrible things about stuff, but he's like an accepted guy as far as reviews go. And then I felt, like I said, I had said everything I wanted to say. And at that era, people were saying, everyone was talking about games and no one was playing games. And I was like, that's kind of true, maybe. And that's when I decided I wanted to shift to doing actual plays. And so my first actual plays are actually some of my good buddies who I had first interviewed for Hobbs and Friends, like Jose Licario, Eric Hoffman, Paul Wolf, my good buddy John Bird. We did a 5e campaign when 5e first came out, and it was my own made up homebrew stuff, and we just put it out there, and it was ridiculous because you had Roll 20, but you didn't really know how to like bracket it out or use OBS or all these other tools that people have for streaming now. They might have existed, I just didn't know about them. So right. It's terrible. So like the first part of it, there's a whole video of Jose trying to figure out how to get everyone on the call and be in the thing. It's like a half hour long. And he's like, all right, now, because you know, he has that really deep throaty, all right, everybody now log in. And we're like, oh, okay. and then I would make someone turn their video off and have their Roll 20 instance so people could see the map. And then, you know, over time, when you were playing, I mean, it was kind of like a done production. We'd figured out how to do it by then. And like I say, we did a ton of episodes of Kalmata, which was really started as BX. And then when OSE came out, it shifted into OSE, which are, you know, the same game pretty much. And it was awesome. And then I started running Low Fantasy Gaming online. And then I did some other games, and all of those were awesome. The greatest thing about Kalmata to me was I always said anything that you learned as a player, your character could know, you would just say it was a rumor or whatever. So you could watch every single Kalmata video and get all the information you wanted to help decide what you wanted to do as a player. And being able to have those online really like brought people in. They were like, oh, and like you said, oh, I'm going to be some superstar on the show. You found out that you're not. You're just some dude who played in this game. But other people who watched all those videos, to them, you would be a superstar. They'd be like, man, Jason, how did you get into that game?
Yeah.
It's great. I mean, it's been an awesome road. And then I changed jobs again, and I just didn't have the ability to schedule things very well because I don't really get my schedule until every morning. So it's hard for me to say what I'm doing on Wednesday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, right. You know, because I just don't know. And so that kind of fell on the wayside. And I don't know. Do you have anything you want to have any questions about any of that that you wanted to mention, or is that
well, too long? No. That's. I mean, you touched on a lot of the things that I kind of wanted to talk about. So when it comes to the podcasting, I mean, you did, like you said, you did the Hobbs and Friends, Random Screed, and then you even did Hex Talk, which was really popular. Feel like there was a lot of people that really enjoyed it and still do. They re-listen to them. Mm-hmm. So is there any like hope that you may come back to the podcasting at some point in the future, or is this like a done thing for you that you're sort of finished with that part of your life?
I can tell you that at least 3 or 4 times a year, we talk about doing Hex Talk. My good buddy Arlen Walker really wants to do the Librem Society again, which was actually a literary live show that was streamed, but we were always going to turn it into a podcast, never did. Hex Talk especially, because in all reality, when I was nominated for an Annie for Hobbs and Friends, the episode that I didn't even have anything to do with that. I was still on the network, and the guy who runs it, he's like, hey, we're all the podcasts we're sending into the Annie Awards. You know, what are you sending in? What do you want to do? I'm like, ah, man, I have 25 people listen to the show. I don't care what we send in. And the one he picked was Hex Talk 1, which was actually on Hobbs and Friends, me, Jose and Eric did a Hobbs and Friends, but we did it like it was a different podcast. I did that a few times to do different testings and just try, instead of just interviewing someone, I would say, this is my new idea for a new show. Like I did an Old West one with David Beatty and Eric Hoffman, who'd also done some Westerns. So we called it Odd Chaps, which I thought was pretty funny. Obviously, you don't.
I mean, I'd never even heard of this. I didn't know that. Yeah. I'd heard of the Librem Society. I think you guys had started talking about Malazan.
That's what the whole thing was, is we were going to deep dive into Malazan Book of the Fallen. And then every other episode would be a special guest and we would do a different short story and just dive into that, you know, just talking about all the characters and then trying to bring it back into role playing. And how would you do the game like this? Or there's lots of that in almost all of those old stories. So that's what the Librem Society was. But this was a Western thing that we keep talking about doing. Eric Hoffman did a game called Black Powder, Black Magic, which was built on the DCC chassis. Very simple. It was four zines, and that's all there ever was. Great game. And David Beatty, both these guys are good friends of mine. David Beatty did Weird Frontiers, which is a massive 1,000-page book, which is also built on the DCC chassis. And I've always been talking about making a Western game. I have now. Which is all of 24 pages. So there's a big difference about all these.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, that's the podcasting. And I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Well, it's more like if you think that that's something that you would go back to.
Like I say, not even a few months ago, I was talking to Eric Hoffman and I said, hey, man, you were my first guest on Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. If I bring it back for a season 2, I'd like you to be my first guest. And he's like, absolutely. And then Paul Wolf, like I said, I already have a big long list of people that want to do it. And I think all it's going to take is having a schedule that's normal, like a normal 8-to-5 type of job during the week, the weekends off. And then I could schedule like this. And it probably most likely maybe could be back, because I have found I do have a lot to say, because I've just been blathering for like 20 minutes. It feels like. So the answer is, I don't know, what's the magic eight ball when you used to shake it up? It would have said probably, most likely, but I don't know.
So I guess the same answer would apply to like Kalmata then, being as a, you don't have a schedule that you can, you know, rely on. It must be, it, you know, scheduling games, because you used to like be like, hey guys, it felt like a real Wes Marches game, in the sense that people would call, like tell you, hey bro, I want to play. I've got a group of people who are willing to like do the thing. This is where we want to go. And then you'd be like, this is when I'm free, and it would happen.
Like, that's just exactly the way we ran it.
Like,
exactly.
It was 100% like pure Ben Player Robbins, driven. West Marches, not like these people who are like, I'm doing a West Marches game, but like yours was a real West Marches game.
Well, I'm not going to say what's real or true or isn't. I felt like, to me, it's, you know, what he had in mind at the time. I would say that the way that it progressed isn't perfect West Marches, if that's such a thing, just by the way it wasn't always more dangerous the farther you got away. Sometimes you could get very dangerous very close to the safe town. Mm-hmm. But Kalmata was a fantastic thing, and I will probably never run Kalmata again.
Really?
One of the big players, Aaron Coleman, passed away. And he had a 6th-level wizard. And you know how hard it is to survive in that game. And his character, we ran it at North Texas a few years ago, and he then passed away a month or two after that. And we kind of got where we wanted to go with his character. And I let out some secrets that had never been seen. Some of the other players who had characters in the 4th, 5th, 6th level were like, I can't believe you had 3 ropers there and expected us to do something with that, because they're nasty in OSC, like sick nasty. And, but he passed away. And ever since then, I've never really been, it just became so much entwined with Aaron,
right?
That I just never felt comfortable running it again. But I don't know if you used to remember, but I would do that voice in the beginning of each session. would talk, but there's more. So what I did do instead is I made an entirely new area, a new biome called the Gelid Glens of Gar. And it kind of has Easter eggs tipping back to the character. It's basically kind of saying that a bunch of those characters left, followed Bajir Gar, who was Aaron's character, into this frozen tundra of the north, a forgotten unknown frontier, and we've probably played 20 sessions of that now. So it's kind of the still a West Marches game, still player driven, all of it's the same, except it's a whole new area with all different, you know, NPCs, monsters, secrets. It's actually probably better than Kalmata because I knew what I was doing now, right, instead of, you know, because originally Kalmata was just based on Eric Hoffman's Treasure Vaults of Zatabod. I had just moved the timeline up 50 years. And so people could see the secrets because a bunch of us that were playing knew that adventure pretty well. And I did the same thing with Jellid Glens, but now it's really Easter eggs to all the people that had ever played before. I have not streamed any of those just because it's been difficult, but if I ever did stream again, that's probably one of the games that I would definitely do.
That's amazing. What would be, I definitely want to get into your bite the bullet thing, but you've just really like piqued my interest. So for somebody who wanted to set up a West Marches game, I mean, I almost feel like this could be like an entire episode by itself. Maybe we should do that, but just like as a quick kind of piece of advice, like what would you say is the sort of secret sauce to setting up a West Marches like that?
I would say almost like any game, one of the number one things is you got to have the player base. You got to have people who are as vested as you are, which is rare because usually it's the GM that gives a poop about it, right? And so one of my ideas, and I think something that really helped, players don't want to read two or three pages of background, especially if they'd have never met you. And it's every Kalmata game was kind of a one shot because it's West Marches. It started in town, you did what you were doing, and you went back to town. So in some ways it feels like a one shot, but it's a episodic one shot. So everything that happened before is still there consistently into the future. So you want to keep good records of what's going on, which I was not that good at, but a lot of times I had videos that I could go back and look if one guy was like, "Hey, I remember this thing." And I'd be like, "Oh shit." All I would have is like a hex number and a sentence. Well, I could go back to the video or I could start, you know, rolling through my notes and find it. So you want to be consistent, take some pretty decent notes, have a player base that wants to do it and stick to your guns on it. If it's the player driven thing, make the players do it. It's herding cats, but now you don't have to herd them. So you can spend more time on the actual game, thinking about where you want it to go, whatever. But don't feel like you have to do it all. Kalmata started with Sindonor, the little island and tower just off the isthmus into the, and that was it. That's all I had when I ran the first session of Kalmata. But now in that little map, which I don't even know how big it is, you know, it was a 1 mile hex that I did, but it was based off of a 6 mile hex from Treasure Vaults of Zatabod. Not that big of an area, but just massively full of stuff. And you could do the Stonehell idea where you have a big idea of why there would be so much stuff in this little area, but players don't have to know that. And one of the things I was getting to is some players want all that backstory, but they want to find it out through play. So don't have a massive document that people have to read because they're not going to read it anyway. All I did is there were some certain rules, like no elves. And I had a reason in game for that, not just because of Courtney Campbell's racist hate of elves. Everything that happens in the game is serious, right? It's real to those characters, but you can have as good a time as a player that you want. That's another one of my basically ideas. And always wear pants. Mm. Always have a shirt on. These are all very important aspects of the game. Did I get to anything that you're surprised by? And that's what I was going to say. The last thing is, just because the players don't have a huge backlore document doesn't mean you don't. So if a player really starts to delve into things, like you'll mention, you won't say that, oh, it looks like a piece of armor from some old settlement or culture. You'll say the name of the culture. You don't say anything else about it. If they want to know, then they'll look into it and they'll find out. And always give advantages to the players who actually know what the cultures that are existing. Like if they know the culture of their character, if it's something made up or if they never cared, you don't care. It doesn't matter. It's mostly a one shot. They may never play again. But if they play for 20 more times, they may like make a decision. Oh yeah, I know I'm a Keldoran and I was in the Legion and this happened. And oh, so then you're aware that in, you know, 300 years ago in the early days of the Keldoran Legion, this is the type of armor they wore. They could be like, oh, so there were legionnaires here. I wonder why they were here. And then start digging into that. Whereas if you never wanted to know that as a player, you didn't need to, but it would be an advantage to you if you did.
Mm. No, that's
I found really, that was really enticing to people.
That's fascinating. I think what is a revelation to me is that I'd never really thought about it that way, but that each session is a one shot. Like I'd
it
never,
really is, yeah.
I think just changing that perspective on how you look at your game probably changes things drastically. At least it would for me. Like in my mind, I think I get overwhelmed a lot when I get these ideas for campaigns or whatever. And then I feel like, especially even solo, like I've been really, really wanting to solo. And I kind of had this revelation yesterday when I was, you know, thinking about stuff like, how come I haven't gotten this done yet? And it was like, I keep putting more things on the plate, like, oh, before I can do that, I need to add this. I need to do this. And you're making it bigger and bigger instead of just, you know, if you look at it like, oh, dude, it's just one session. You just need to get one session, you know, start. Yeah. You started small. I have one starting place. I have one adventure site. And then it grew from there. And, you know, I can't imagine that I'm the only person who feels this way, that, you know, you're like, oh, man, there's too much. I feel overwhelmed.
I've done it for years like that. And it, you just do it. It's just like designing a game and actually publishing it. You got to do the work. You just got to do it. You don't have to have a massive know everything, know your next 25 books you want to put out, like you say. And you don't even have to know everything. You just say, hey, this is the starting town. What do you want to do? And then you give them three rumors, and they could all be the same thing, lead them to them. Because I also ran Kalmata at conventions. And so obviously a one shot in that situation. Mm-hmm. But I would always tell people that, hey, this is a living campaign. Bring your character back and you can play again. And so then people could, that was an enticement to some people, but I always, it would still affect the rest of the campaign because it still was in the continuity of Kalmata. So right. It was always going on. And I think that's when I realized that they were all one shots, to be honest.
Tell us, like, what is Bite the Bullet? What inspired you to start working on this? Especially because there's a lot of other Western games out there.
And more are coming out every minute, it feels like.
Yeah.
So I would say there were really a couple things that I really wanted to do in my Western. I never knew exactly what the chassis or the core system was going to be, but I always wanted them to have this aspect. One of those things is social combat or social conflict, a way for people for characters to interact with NPCs or each other in a way that felt more realistic. And that's something I've always wanted. I feel like it's something that's missing. Usually it's a reaction role, or in old school games, it could be a reaction role, or it could be the GM is NPCing the character and the player is role-playing their character and they have a conversation. And usually the character is trying to get information and the NPC is just there as a foil for them to get it from. That's not realistic in any way to me. And I don't mean you have to have realism in your fantasy games, but the world should work in a way that you understand as a player. And so then you can use that or leverage that as a character. That's something that I feel is very important in a game. And in those situations where the GM is NPCing the character, he's doing the NPCing, right? Usually the conversations are only going to work as a player if you figure out the way that you have to ask the question to the GM. You know what I'm, because they have something in mind, or otherwise right. The character is never going to give you the information you want.
Right.
Or like the situation where, oh, I captured one of the brigands. I want to find out where the fort is. The GM could play that and often does as very difficult for you to get that information.
Mm-hmm.
Because there really isn't any system for them to do it. You could do a reaction roll, but it doesn't seem right that just because your wizard has a 17 charisma and a +2 on a 2d6 roll that, oh, he just shows up. And so the guy's going to give you all the information. It makes no sense. So I feel like those are flawed. And you have some, hey, I can, in other games that have skill systems, it's the same thing. Maybe I'm rolling on... Sometimes it's an opposed role, but that seems pretty anticlimactic compared to some of the great scenes that you see in movies or you read in books where your protagonist is trying to figure something out from a powerful NPC, and it takes 20 pages because, you know, they're doing these different ideas, they're using rhetoric, they're trying to figure something out. And that game, I have never played a game that tries to do that. And I wanted this game to do that. And so that was one of the main reasons that I did this game. As far as inspirations go, We Deal in Lead is probably the first key to unlock what became Bite the Bullet. Because I'm a big fan of Dark Tower, which We Deal in Lead is kind of an Into the Odd Cairn based role-playing game by Colin LeSueur that has the serial numbers filed off of Stephen King's Dark Tower. But that's really what you're doing. You're playing your own order in some sort of kind of gunslingers from the Dark Tower, even though they're not always using those terms, because like I said, the serial numbers are filed off. And the idea of having that as a base is a pretty strong lore. Like, I've heard you talk about the Dark Tower and the tower and how it builds everything on it. There's a multiverse, so it could come from different time eras. It could do whatever. And I never knew how to play Into the Odd or Cairn. I read them, but to me, it's a very different perspective or point of view as a game compared to my old school traditional view, right? The GM knows everything. You roll the hit, blah, blah, blah. You do all these things where it's different. And I felt like I didn't totally grok it. So I was on a search for people to run it for me. So at conventions, I would try to get into every Into the Odd game that I could, try to convince people that I knew who played it. And when I played it, sometimes I was kind of underwhelmed, honestly. It's like, I'm not sure about this. So finally I got to a place where I started to run We Deal in Lead and had a blast, but it still didn't really have the social conflict mechanism that I was looking for. But I realized I could use the exact same system on a different attribute that they use for a physical conflict. And so all I had to do is change the attributes and use the exact same system. And now I had what I wanted. And the game got different enough, the We Deal in Lead game. So I bolted that on in one of my campaigns for We Deal in Lead. And the player's like, oh, this is kind of interesting. But I still felt like it was missing. I didn't want to have, there's no classes and there's no skills. All there are those three attributes that you really only roll when you're making a save on them. You don't really roll them to see if you figure something out or anything like that. That's not the way the game works. But in my traditional way, a lot of times I would do things like that. I still don't in my system. But what I did is I felt like in games, a lot of times when your players want to be able to level up their characters, right? And that goes in different ways. You could put it on different things, but there's not a lot of attributes in a simple system like Into the Odd that if you leveled things up very quickly, the characters would be very, very powerful. It kind of reminds me, this is self-referential to the Anchorites, but when you hear Jason Connerly talking about the game of the Black Hack that they all ran in that campaign, and Joey Richter says it's not a campaign game because there's no growth in the characters, and if there is, the growth comes too fast. So what I wanted to do is add another system on that would grow, the characters would have growth, but it wouldn't be like, all right, you get more hit points, you get more skills, you get more things you can do, because in this system, those things really don't exist. And so it occurred to me that in the medias that I'm often trying to simulate, the characters have growth, but I mean, Clint Eastwood from Outlaw Josie Wales he kind of always had the skills that he has in the beginning of the movie that he had at the end of the movie, but his growth came in his demeanor, how he cared about the other people Three Mules for Sister Sarah, how he cared about the people he was with, how his characteristics that made him changed, made him do things differently that actually helped him in the long run because of those things. So it's really character growth is where I wanted it to be in my game. And so what I did is I created five characteristics that you could tap into or you could use to help you in any of the other systems or help defend you in any other system. So that's kind of what you have. You have three attributes, five characteristics. So if you're trying to do something, you don't roll the hit in this game. All you do is do damage. So you pull out your revolver, and always the GM in an Into the Odd game, the GM tenet is you have to show, like, if there's any danger, you're always, man, I can't even come up with my words, dude. It's early.
The telegraphing.
Telegraphing, yeah, it's the number three thing on the very first page. telegraph danger. So you always, that's the difference in this game compared to like OSE or something, where you say, all right, you guys are walking through an old Mesa village, you know, stucco buildings are all around you, dust is swirling, a tumbleweed flies by, and Weeb glances up because he sees a glint of light that has to be a rifle barrel, and it's moving from one side. You can just see the rifle underneath a tarp as it goes away from you and starts to point towards you. What do you do? So that's telegraphing. So you would answer and say what you do, and then you would take that into consideration in how it goes. And so that's how I always run the game and how I'd expect anyone to. You wouldn't have to, because as soon as you have the game and you're running it, you do it however the heck you want to. So say the person, when they fight the other character, the NPCs will also have characteristics. So what that characteristic would do, that guy is known as a big game hunter, is one of his characteristics, and the rank is one. So that means when he rolls his damage, which is normally a D6, he could get a plus one on it. Now Weeb, he's been in quite a few gunfights, so he's got one that says experienced gunfighter, so he knows to take cover when anyone's getting ready to shoot him. He would say, all right, I want to tap experienced gunfighter, and now you get a plus one to your armor to withstand that weapon, that shot. And that's kind of how the characteristics work.
Interesting. It's I thought so. This kind of brings up like one of the concepts that we kind of hear often in games, where it's like, it's not about the system, it's about the game. And clearly, in your case, I mean, system matters, right? I mean, and I think this is the tension that many of us as game masters have experienced, is this like trying to find the system that like goes with what we're trying to emulate in the game, you know? So like system matters to a point, right?
It definitely can matter to a point, yes, because but it doesn't have to, right? Because Connolly would say it's okay for you to play Weeb and me to play Mr. Rutherford, the general store manager, and we just RP it out. That's the way we've always done it. That's what we want to do.
Right.
But to Jason Hobbs, I didn't feel like that simulated what I was looking for, and so I wanted to create a system that did it. But two guys are good. Like Jason Weeb has obviously got some charisma because he's doing podcasts and he has some charisma, so his characters are going to have charisma, right? It's just the way it works. So the guy who has some charisma is probably going to do better in a social engagement, not necessarily a social conflict, because I don't even think they use those terms in most trad games. But
Right.
when he has a social conflict with Mr. Rutherford, he's going to be better at it than John Byrd, who's a wallflower but likes rolling
Right.
dice and likes to look into lore. And that doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah. No, I would
So.
agree. I feel like that's always been a frustration of mine, is this concept of like, you know, I had a friend who argued like, well, why are you making me talk my way through this encounter when you wouldn't make me like actually swing a real sword to like do a fight or shoot a gun? And so I think that, you know, what you're talking about here, your design really like hits on that. It really like finds a way of, you know, giving real meaning to a social conflict. I really like that. So if I'm understanding correctly, essentially what you're saying is you've got sort of like social hit points. Is that kind of fair to say?
So there is like hit points in the game, and when I first bolted the social conflict onto the We Deal in Lead game, yes, you in We Deal in Lead you have say grit, which is your hit points, and it comes back every scene really quickly. But if when your grit goes down, now it goes into your attributes, and it's possible you would be out of that conflict. Okay, so I had a thing that was like resolve, and then you also had grit, and resolve was only for your. Which reminds me, there is one other big inspiration of this game. There's a game called Griftlands, which is a, this is like an aside, and you may not be good, but it was a huge inspiration to, because you have, it's a deck of cards game, it's a video game, and you have social cards and you have physical cards, and you play them and you go through these, and it's the same mechanics, they're just different cards. And you go through these some of the times you can get into a physical conflict with your opponent, or you can get into the social conflict. And so that's why I was like, oh, this is what it should be like. But I'm not going to make a whole bunch of card decks because that's just not my gig. Mm-hmm. So anyway, back to your actual, I just wanted to say that was also a huge inspiration.
No, that's interesting.
How I thought, so go look at Griftlands if you've never seen it, then you can see kind of maybe like, oh, this is kind of the basis of what he was thinking. So ask me your question again, because I got lost.
So is it safe to say that this is like social hit points that we're talking about?
All right. So, but then I realized in that game, it uses one set of hit points and not for different ones, because when your character is involved and he goes to the church of Father Christian, who they believe has, you know, a basement where a kidnapped girl is, but they don't know. And Father Christian has enough renown in the town that you can't just go in there guns blazing or you're going to be criminals, right?
Right.
So this has to be a social conflict, okay? But if that social conflict turns into a physical conflict, the effect that happened in the social conflict should still exist in the physical, because you can get beat down, you can be angry, you can still be affected how you physically act in a what happened socially, right? And so instead of having two different ones, I have one, and it's called sand. So you're saying, and most of the time damage is going to be a D6. Like I say, there's no rolls to hit. A social conflict, you can play it however you want. So like if you're the type of person in a physical conflict that says, I swing, here's the die roll, you missed or whatever. But if you're the guy who says, all right, I want to duck under the blow, pull out my dagger and try and cut up, you know, you kind of describe what you're doing. You can also do a game like that. So you can do the same thing in this game, but say in a social conflict, you can say, all right, I want to do a social conflict. Usually I always try to find out what the intent is. Like, what are you trying to find out? Okay, well, this is what this NPC is trying to find out. So in a social conflict, you could lose. And what happens when you lose in a social conflict, it's something to consider, which you don't normally, you know, because you do them every day in your life.
Right.
Like you're talking to the police officer that just pulled you over. You really don't want a ticket, but you kind of have rules of engagement that you have to follow. Mm. And so you may, all right, I want to compliment him on his uniform. So like that's what you're really doing, is saying, instead of just saying swinging your sword, I want to do something specific. And so you can get into the details of a social conflict, just like you do a physical conflict, if that's the type of player you are, but you don't have to. You can just say, all right, you guys are in a social conflict. All right, roll D6. Oh, nice job. You did a 5. Oh, but I'm also glib tongued. I have a characteristic that glib tongued rank 1. So now you do D6. All right. You're doing that against him. He's the cop. He's like, well, I should go back to the Father Christian actually, because otherwise I'm making this example really difficult to follow. So anyway, what I decided is one thing, and then that gets eroded and that comes back every, and sand is kind of like, sometimes you'll get beaten down by your environment. Sometimes you'll get beaten down, you know, by physical conflict, and sometimes you'll get beaten down by social conflict. Or in this game, you could actually get beaten down by faith conflict as well, because those are your three attributes. And so your sand will go down. It rejuvenates usually after every scene. So it's down as it goes. But you could have a physical conflict that erodes it. You could have a social conflict that erodes it. Depending on the type of damage or conflict you were in at the time that your sand went to zero, that's what attribute it would affect. So one, hit points. It's like hit points. It's not exactly hit points, but it's very much like hit points. That number goes up and down continuously throughout a session and a campaign.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I really like the idea of these different sort of like, because when I was looking at it, it was like, okay, I pulled up the PDF, but it disappeared on me here. Let's see if I can.
You're not the, I'll just blab while you're looking for it. You're not the first person. I mean, almost everybody, when they read it, they're like, wow, there's a lot of fascinating pieces to this that maybe I've kind of seen before, but are also kind of new the way that you're doing. To me, it's a very tight system where there's only a few systems that exist in the game. There's not a ton of subsystems, but the way they interact with each other to me is kind of novel, but you don't really know what it is. You can look at it and think it's pretty interesting, but how would this actually work at the table? Is that what you're going to mention or no?
I'm kind of
talk long enough, did I?
Yeah, hold on. It's coming up now. There we go. Yeah, so I mean, okay, so what do you have the, come on, man. We're going to have to do some editing now. I had laid out everything so that I would get access, and then when I opened up Zoom, it got rid of it, and I don't know where it
Technology
went.
is awesome.
Yeah, okay, so we got vigor, presence, and faith. Yeah, so I thought like this was actually really cool, right? Because I feel like these really like encapsulate the sort of like major pillars of us as like people, right? So like this vigor,
It's all
endurance,
physical.
yeah. And then I also like how when I was reading through the document, you had like really kind of like little funny little snippets there, like you got hardcore parkour, you know, things like that, where I was like, okay, yeah, this is it's fun to read. And so like presence, so you're like, these are your like, I guess more like social skills. And then faith, which I guess is more of your like internal kind of like,
Belief.
yeah. So
It
yeah.
doesn't have to be Christianity. It doesn't have to be, because this game is really a post-apocalyptic, a post-apocalyptic event happened sometime during the Civil War. That's what this game is. And
Okay.
then two or three generations have passed. So, and enough of the population of the United States and presumably the rest of the world was decimated. No one cares. I shouldn't say no one, but 99% of the population does not care what your politics were before. They don't care what color you are. They don't care your creed. They don't care anything about that, because survival was so difficult that it didn't matter anymore. If we were going to kill people or conflict with those people because of those situations, humanity is done, right? That was the premise. And I did that purposely because I didn't want that to be what the game was about. It was about creed or nationality or religion, because there's enough of that that exists. This is really a game about what humanity does in the face of massive adversity. And there's two lines that pretty much tell you that. Every town is a candle against a vast dark. Every ride into the wilderness is a wager with death. Those were the tenets of the game, and I wanted to follow that up with. So in We Deal in Lead and most Into the Odd games, you have strength, dexterity, and then another attribute that kind of helps you deal with things that are probably occultish, supernatural,
Right.
whatever. And so in my game, I was like, it makes no sense for it to be strength and dexterity, because I want a social aspect in there. So why wouldn't it just be one physical, one social, and then one other, depending on whatever the genre or whatever I was trying to emulate? And so
Right.
that's why those are the three attributes. So did that. Oh, and I'd also say that the writing in here is super terse. I think that there are things in there that you might laugh about, but I put hardcore parkour in there because 90% of the people reading this either have heard that before, and to them, it kind of means the same thing to most people. But if it's not exactly the same thing, it still has something to do with your physicality, right?
Right. Yeah. I also thought it was interesting that you use the word tap to like say for the use of your abilities.
Characteristics. Yeah,
Yeah.
your characteristics.
So what would A, are you worried about getting sued by Wizards of the Coast for stealing their magic term? And then which I highly doubt would ever happen, but what no, well, like in all seriousness, what was the like the meaning, I that's not really a good
Why
way
did
of
I
putting
choose
it.
tap?
Yeah,
That's your question, right?
essentially, yeah.
So I wanted, like I said, your characteristics are one of the things that really shows character growth. Okay, so there needs to be a way for you to get better at those. And the way that I came up with, the more you used it, the better you were going to get. But I didn't want it to be too fast, so I needed a way to limit it. I'm answering the question. It's just I want to contextualize it a little
Yep.
bit. So I don't want one person just to sit there and spam their background, which could be homesteader, right? Their background's homesteader. There's a lot of things that you could use homesteader for. And I should also say this game is a minimalistic rule set. So Jason Weeb, as the GM, may accept homesteader for dealing with endurance or trying to say, hey, I'm a homesteader. I've been baling hay my whole life. I'm a farmer. The chances of me surviving falling off this cliff is better than this guy over here who was a telegraph operator, right? But Jason Hobbs may not feel that way. He's like, oh, that's not enough. So it's really a conversation between player and GM, whether or not a characteristic works for a particular situation, right? So, but I don't want them to always use Homesteader. So that's why you have other, you really have four other main characteristics that you can use. So when you use a characteristic on the character sheet, there's a little circle that you fill in. You always, all your characteristics start at rank one. When you get to 10 characteristics from to go from uses, you get from to go from rank one to rank two, you don't just automatically get it. Now you roll a D6, and if it's higher than your current rank, then you go up a rank, right? And at, in play, instead of you saying uses or, hey, did you use your characteristic? Did you this time, did you use your foible or your fortitude? I found myself saying tap. It just naturally came out. And I guarantee tap is not a trademarked word, first of all. And especially since we're not using cards, there's no way it could get confused.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, when I first was writing and explaining how I wanted to do the game, they were like, tap, that seems like a weird use. But in my mind, it is almost kind of like tapping your mana in order to use your characteristic.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like that in to me in my brain when I think about how the game works. So that's why I use tap.
No, it definitely, it felt appropriate. At first I was like, oh, that's weird. But then as I was reading through further, I was like, oh no, that actually makes a lot more sense. It feels almost as if like when you're playing and you're sort of narrating what you're doing as a character, it keeps you within your character a little bit more than, I don't know, I use my, I don't know, it feels like I'm tapping into my part of my person, my character, as opposed to like, okay, well, my character is going to use their blah, blah, blah. So,
yeah. And you could say it that way if you want. This just seemed to be the, and also say use of fortitude felt weird in the rule set, but I felt saying tap was a better description of what was happening.
Yeah. No, I think you're onto something there. So like you said, you're a very busy person now. You've got like a different kind of work schedule than you had before. What was your creative process like for creating this?
So I just kind of started writing. Like some of this stuff didn't exist until later. Like I had two different, I had something else. The bond didn't exist as one of the characteristics. In We Deal in Lead, there are things like background, reputation, fortitude, foible, and issue that you roll on. But just like a quick descriptor, I don't know if you remember, but in Kalmata, I would point people to a particular character generator on Rom's website, save versus total party kill or something like that. And it would give you like three little descriptors underneath hey, this is a dwarf fighter, level one. And then underneath it would say squat and fat, forked beard, bushy eyebrows. Same thing in We Deal in Lead. They're just descriptors. Well, I'm like, well, why won't we use these descriptors in the game mechanics? And that's how I figured out what those were. And then that game also had like random roles for those things instead of having to make them. You could easily make them up yourself. So I kind of did the same thing. So a lot of this is based off of the way Into the Odd and We Deal in Lead are written. Almost all the Into the Odd books do, though. If you know anything about Into the Odd, they kind of have a feel and the way they're written. So I use that as a basis. And in reality, then I sent it off to my layout and design / editor, Brian Tackle, and he made it look like this. All right. I did not write it like this. This makes my writing look like I know what the heck I'm doing. He is a professional graphic artist, so he's not messing around, but I'm fortunate enough to have him as a buddy. And I asked him, man, I'm like, how much is it going to cost me for you to make this pretty? And he's like, you can't afford me, but I'll do it.
No, it definitely, I love the style, and it really flows. Like it's just busy enough to like look pretty, but like it's simple enough and straightforward enough that reading through it is pleasurable. Talking about the character generator went from Kalmata. you have a character generator for this, for Bite the Bullet. So how did that come about? And because I tried it out last night and I was like, wow, this is really like high tech stuff, man. Like, this is really cool.
It's kind of insane, isn't it? The way that happened is, so I released, to get a little bit more about my process, I was sending people my versions of the game to look at. I was like, hey, this is my game. Check it out. What do you think? Use it if you want to, whatever. I'm going to send it out, pay what you want anyway. So it's not like it's hurting me to share it with you. I'm not hiding anything. It's not some big secret thing that I'm going to release on the world and it's going to make a big splash. I knew that wasn't what it was. So I just wanted to share it with people and get as much information as possible. And there were, we found during play and play testing and reading, hey, there's not enough here. Fill it in. What is this? Why doesn't this work? Hey, I just realized that this doesn't exist. So you have to write it. And then Brian has to figure out where it fits in the book. That was my process. And now to move on to your next question, which I already forgot what the question was. Sorry.
The character generator.
Oh, the character generator. So I released this maybe a week ago, maybe less, on itch.io. And my plan was always to do pay what you want, because there was going to be no art, because it's going to be my time and now Brian's time, because he agreed and we never expected any money. The idea was that if it got enough engagement and people were interested in it, I would hire an artist. I would hire James Richards, who does most of my art now, for all of my other existing products that have never come out yet, but they will. Anyway, one of the people who saw it when I posted it on Discord got it, Michael Spreadman, who has his own gaming company that I should tell you, but I don't know. He was like, he bought it and he's like, hey, I did this. I'm a super fan. And I was like, oh, you're not a super fan unless, you know, you're sharing it to everyone. You're getting other people to die. I was just messing with them, obviously, right? He was like, I know what his profession is. And currently he's a consultant for like programming. And he wasn't. And I was like, hey, do you think you could do a character generator? Because there's not a lot to character generation in this game. Honestly, it's like 8 roles pretty much. And if you do it all randomly, it's not that hard. And the next day he sent me a text and he's like, hey man, I got this character generator for you. You want to check it out? And I was like, oh dude, I'm golfing today. This is my day off. I'm whatnot. And then I got to watch movies with my wife. And then I got a game later. And so later that night, he texted me again. He's like, come on, man, check this out. And I was like, oh, whatever. I totally appreciate it, but it wasn't like I expected it to be what it is. My thought process was, one of my favorite things about Mothership was one of the systems I had considered using as the basis for this game, because I love the character generation in Mothership, and the idea of the pressure and how that affects you would be perfect for a Western, really. I've seen other character generators. Like I said, Rams, I've always used that as the basis for my OSE con games or whatever, because I even make up my own 3 things and it's super interesting to see who uses them versus who doesn't. And it's just a simple, easiest thing. But when you come to a con game, you don't really have an idea unless you just play the same character every time. But now you can use those and kind of delve into them. And the way people do it has been so fascinating to me that I thought, oh, if I had this, then I could send it to people. And if I want to make a character real quick, I can play with it, whatever. And he did such a fantastic job on it. And he did it in a day. I mean, like I released this thing a week ago. He never had seen the game before that, other than the little bits that I had been putting on my Discord and stuff. And I put that out on a couple other Discords, and immediately people were like, "Hey, I just rolled a cold-eyed killer who might have burnt down a church and still believes in his faith, and I can't wait to play this character. What do I have to do?" Because all you got to do is push a button on that generator. Right. Whereas to actually get the game, you got to push a link and then go to the website itch.io, then download, which is actually takes, what, 30 seconds, really?
Yeah,
but no. People don't necessarily want to do it because they don't have any idea if they're that interested in it. But if I send you a link to the thing and you push the button and now you got a character, you're kind of like, whoa, maybe I should download this game, you know?
Yeah.
So it was, and also I told him, hey, I'm not planning on making any money on this game. So maybe you can use it to get another job, because you said, hey, I made this application for this purpose. This is how, because one of my other buddies was looking for a job who's a programmer. And I know that's a way that they put those on their resumes to try and get jobs. Right. And
right.
So I thought, hey, you could use this for that. And so I got the one of the best layout guys I've ever seen. And then I got a guy who can make a character generator who is also now finished with the Foundry module for We Deal in Lead. And he's moving on to the character sheet for Roll 20 for We Deal in Lead, but obviously my game, Bite the Bullet.
Right.
So the thing that I've always been excited about in our tabletop role-playing community is 99% of the people are fantastic. And all they want to do is talk to other people who love their hobby. And I've been lucky enough for those people to do art or layout or make me an awesome random character generator.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's for sure. I mean, so it's interesting you're talking about Foundry, because back in the day when I was playing with you, it was over Roll 20. Is that your new VTT is Foundry, or are you still a Roll 20 guy?
I'm totally a Roll 20 guy, but he knew more about Foundry.
Okay.
So he wanted to make a Foundry. He goes, hey, do you mind if I make a Foundry module? The rules will be available. Do you want to charge for it? I'm like, well, I'm not charging for the game. Why would I charge for the Foundry module?
Right.
Unless you want to for your work.
Right.
And I go, you just keep it all if you want to. I don't care. I've played a lot of games on Foundry, but I'm super busy and to learn. I'm not natural. I mean, I shouldn't say that because it's not true. For 13 years, I was a programmer before I got into sales and the water treatment industry. So you would think that I know it to how to program, because in Foundry, there's the powers, the ability for the user are much better than they are in Roll 20.
Okay.
Roll 20 to me is way more intuitive, but I got 7,000 hours on Roll 20.
Right.
So for me to take the amount of time that it would take to get as good on Foundry as I am on Roll 20, probably not going to. I might now. I mean, I got to test out this Foundry module, right? I own it.
Yeah.
You only have to pay $50 when you buy it, or 30 if you get it on sale. Why not? But I think the reason we have a Foundry module is because Michael is a Foundry guy.
Gotcha. So you were talking about stuff that you have more ideas and more things you've been working on. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's planned for the future? Are we going to see more stuff on Itch?
Yeah. So the concept of the Bite the Bullet book and the way that it's laid out, it never really says that it's a post-apocalyptic Civil War game, right? It never says that in this game anywhere. But as you read through the book, I think most people are going to feel like, oh, that's what it is, just by, like I say, the little bits that you read. What are the weapons? What are the gear? What's the stuff that's happening? There is a kind of an implied setting in the book, but it's very light, right? There's not a ton about it. So I have two or three different settings that I've been toying with and playtesting that are getting there, that I'm going to likely put out either through Substack or on Itch. You can get Bite the Bullet on Drive-Thru as well now.
Okay.
Also pay what you want. And another thing that I've always wanted to do is had a turgid sci-fi game, right? Well, guess what? This system can easily be shifted to that. So there is another video game called Colony Ship, a post-Earth sci-fi game, which is the idea of this massive colony ship that was sent out, where you have a whole bunch of people in cryosleep, but you also have the families, because it's hundreds of years to get wherever you're going. So you have generations of families that are there to run the ship, right? And so they grow older, they have kids, and then they continue to run the ship. Well, over 10 generations, the amount that can change in people's belief systems and their the government and their societal norms, all that can change so quickly that it's this grungy, the ship's almost gone. No one really cares why the colony ship is still running, but it still has to run to continue. It's just a super cool video game, which is feels kind of cyberpunky, but it's based on a colony ship. So you're always flying through space. Some people, you still have to keep the life support going, but the people who don't have jobs, they live in the cargo hold where life support kind of sucks anyway. So, I mean, it's just this really cool idea. And so what I did is I tweaked the Bite the Bullet rules to play that game. So I've changed the three attributes. You still have five characteristics. Obviously your weapons are different. Social conflict, physical conflict exists, but the third attribute, instead of being faith-based, is tech-based. And so now anything tech-wise, that's what you're going to use for your tech-based combat, or trying to interact with a subsystem in order to get information, or to, you know, take a piece apart where you're going to change that module that came from this life support system and try and turn it into a gun or whatever, you know. So that's the attribute that you would use for that. And really, that's just kind of molded by, so system matters, but this system I can use to do different. So I also have like a steampunk game that I have some writing done for. I have a colonial game called Weird in the Witchlight. And then I have, I just have done a bunch of different systems, and then I play with them, tweak them, mess around with them. What do I need to change versus what don't I need to change? And then I have the Gelid Glens of Gar that I will deal, I'll be writing. And I actually have this old module that I was supposed to release for Tales of Argosa as a stretch goal that I didn't get done. And Steve let me off the hook and put his own out. And he said, well, when it's ready, well, let's release it then, and I'll pay you whatever, or whatever. James Richards did a ton of art for it, so I kind of left him on the hook. He didn't make no money off of the art that he did. But that's coming out, and I still have an old low fantasy gaming module called The Cinerarium of the Sin Eater, which I did a ton of play testing at cons, that will be released. And I've never had an itch before. Now I do. And it's very simple, and they don't really take very much money compared. Okay. Like 30% is what drive through is on a PDF. 10% is what itch starts at, but you can make it higher if you want to. Okay. So, and obviously I wasn't worried about the money, because these are pay what you want, but still, right, it's nice if someone decides to pay you $5 for your item. It would be nice to get, you know, 90% of that versus 70% of that, that you can put aside for when I make Bite the Bullet Deluxe, which has a ton of art and is a hardcover and has a setting attached to it. Yeah, that's my plan.
Cool, helps. Man. When you, so this has been a lot of like design, like game design. How do you, what do you prefer? Do you prefer writing adventure stuff, or have you found like delving into design has become like your new kind of thing?
I would say I never thought I was a game designer, and I'd always thought I would retire and live off of writing novels or RPG material, settings, adventures, whatever, not game design. But throughout much of my life, even like I said, when I was a kid, we didn't have the rules. And so I actually designed games, and I did that up and throughout my career. When I was in a factory for a while, I once made a mech game that was based on flipping coins. And we made paper things. We put a type of coin and we moved them around a field when we were supposed to be working, obviously. So I've been doing game design my whole life. I just never thought about it like that.
Interesting.
And I'd always wanted to, I wrote a game, Relentless, partially, which was a sci-fi game. And I've been wanting to do game design. I just never thought I knew anything about it. And I honestly, this started with a chassis of another game. I didn't come up with all these ideas. This is strongly built on The End of the Odd. But it's different enough that when I try to talk to people about it in the End of the Odd channels, you're like, this isn't an End of the Odd game. you've spit in the face of a lot of the design choices of End of the Odd by what you're doing. You're using the attributes, not just as savings, you're using them for other things. This isn't End of the Odd, you know, but you're always right. Going to get that. This is an OSR, it's NSR, whatever, right, who cares, right, man? I would say it's easier for me to do adventure design, settings, dungeons, cities, all that stuff. But I do like, this feels like, you know, when it's done,
right?
Can I play the game? It's done. In an adventure, do I need more detail? Do I need less detail? How terse does it need to be? I've given up my OSR cred, because this is obviously not an OSR game, well, it's an NSR game since they have that.
Okay.
That's what I would call it, because it definitely follows that. But like I've already said multiple times, there's no social conflict. I shouldn't say no, because I just played Tales of the Old West for a few sessions. You ever heard of it?
I have not.
It's a brand new Western game built on the XYZ engine. You know what I'm talking about? Mutineer Zero.
Oh, okay. Mutineer Zero. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Who is that?
That's Free League.
Free League. So yeah. I played that game and it has some social aspects that
Interesting.
in some ways I could see how it touches on what I've done. You're tapping into different things, but it's still kind of skillsy. It definitely doesn't have the characteristics or the characteristic growth that Bite the Bullet has, but it's getting there. So I would tell people if you have the opportunity, go play it. The rules is 300 pages or something. This is 24. So I don't know how much time you have for learning a new game, but mine is that I'm like almost 55 years old. If I got another 5 year, 10 years in me, I feel like I'm lucky. I was surprised to be this old. So the amount of time, I've never been a great rule book reader anyway. I've never like sit down and say I want to read the rules. It would be like I'm going to know enough to try to run the game. I'm always going to try and play with somebody who knows the rules better than me so they can just say what the rules are. And then if I need to, I'll learn them as I go. The rules, honestly, I mean, you've looked at it. The rules aren't very much. And we didn't even talk about one of the whole systems that exist in this game. How does the faith work? What are acts of faith? You know, how does the inventory work? What is reserve? We didn't even get into that. And it's a whole nother system that can be affected. There's also other ways to get more experience in the game through the campfire scene or turn, whatever you want to call it. We didn't talk about the bond. There's pieces in here and it's only 24 pages, and but there's not a lot of art.
I mean, that is something that I wanted to ask you was like if there was stuff that I that you wanted to talk about that I missed asking you about or I should have asked you about. So is there something that you're like, dude, I can't even believe that we didn't talk about this?
No, because I know that I've been babbling a long time about the game. And do you want to have something left to read, or should I explain the entire game?
No, that's a good point. Go and download the game, read it,
I always say
internalize it.
download it, look at it. If you don't like it, delete it. I can use more downloads.
There you go.
Share it. Find the link, get the link to, and if you want to put the show notes in the random character generator, go for it. I've already got the okay from Michael. It
Perfect.
was we actually have some advancements that we're dealing with. So a lot of people who read this, I shouldn't say a lot, I mean some of the people I have heard feedback and they say, oh, you know, I'm gonna wear out an eraser erasing these uses or these taps of these characteristics. I'm like, well, I don't know if you've ever seen an old D&D character sheet, but hit points has always been erased, inventory constantly erased. But there's more moving parts in this game that do that. So the inventory uses slots like into the odd. So the number of things you can carry is equal to your vigor with a minimum of 10, right? So you have so many things, and then whatever. So say your max, say you have a vigor of 12, you've used 8 slots, so you have 4 slots left over. Well, that's your reserve, and you use that reserve to do things like status effects affect your reserve. So like if you get poisoned, say you're bit by a rattlesnake, or if you have more weird in your game, which the three different settings that I have for Bite the Bullet that I've been working on, one of them is almost straight Western,
Okay.
one of them is almost like just a touch, and one of them is holy shit, the post-apocalyptic event made stuff really effing weird. So there's a lot more weird in that. But so if you get poisoned, what it does is it adds a status effect, fills up an inventory slot. So now you're lowering your reserve, and it'll usually say something on it like poisoned, you no longer regain your sand until you take a long rest.
Right.
So now your reserve is lower. You don't get your sand back after every scene, which is
A big
horrible,
deal.
right? A very big deal. And then the burdens is another aspect of this game. In most Into the Odd games, like Into the Odd, not Cairn, I don't think, I'm not a huge, I don't know hardly anything about Cairn 1 or Cairn 2. I never played it, but I know these other games are built on it. So I always want to give respect to Yokai about that. Go get Cairn, read it. People love it. It's really a way to use Into the Odd to play old school D&D is what it's supposed to be. They have things called scars, and this is a lot of times how you get character growth in Into the Odd or We Deal in Lead. where it's very specific. So this is how they're controlling what your character growth is. So in my system, you get your characteristics, and then over time using those characteristics, they will likely get better. The better they get, the more unlikely it is for them to get better as you're rolling that die six and needing a higher and higher and higher roll, right?
Yep.
So what scars do is if you take exactly the amount of damage of your sand, I call them burdens, because to me, they're not just scars, because most of the time those, all they have is physical conflict in that game.
Right.
I don't have just physical conflict. I have social conflict, I have physical conflict, and I have faith conflict. So the burdens all tie into that, depending on how much, whatever, however you took the damage. So if your sand goes to exactly zero, you roll on the burden table, and it's a D12, and it's a just a different thing that happens. And some of them, there's always a negative, because obviously you just took damage. So something is happening that's a negative, and there's going to be an effect of that. But there's also a positive, which is like a character growth, where it may be, you took in a physical conflict, you were hit, you roll on the D12, your sand goes to exactly zero. You roll on here, and it says battered and bruised. It could be you're at disadvantage your next physical test. And it also says, but roll 3d6, drop the lowest. If it's higher than your max sand, replace that number with that. So now your sand can go higher, or your vigor can go higher. But it's very, very, very specific, and it's not going to happen very often. So that's another way to get character growth in there. And one of the last things that I added to this game is what I call the campfire.
Yep.
The campfire I got really from, there is a thing that you roll in low fantasy gaming and Tales of Argosa, where when he all of his travel rules are like random events, and sometimes they're hazards, sometimes they're this, but some, there's one that's also called like the campfire, where you set up the perfect camp, and your character, one person could tell a story. If they do a good job, you can give them a luck. If they all do, then you give them all a luck, whatever. It's just I thought it was really interesting. And I think the campfire at its heart, this is, like I say, is a post-apocalyptic Western, but Westerns are really all about liminal horror. They're about the vastness of your environment and trying to deal with that as an individual. And that's how, why this game is laid out the way it is. That's what the cover is really trying to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, when I wrote this game, that's what it was about. And the campfire is a staple for the Western. So at the campfire, you can tell, but it's only going to be decided when a character could say, hey, we just kind of finished an arc. We're on our way to, you know, we beat up Father Christian, and now we got to deal with the rancher, Mr. Rutherford, but we're kind of reflecting on the recent events. And you could actually change your characteristics at the campfire, which is difficult. You can't normally do within the rules. So you could either, you know, increase a rank, but you have to lower a different rank for a different characteristic. Or if you have a new characteristic, you can rename it and start it over at rank one. So I just think that's a really kind of interesting idea, and it is an in-game mechanic that would help the players through their characters talk about what happened and how that affected them. So, because this game doesn't have experience points, where at the end of the session, there's always this time where, hey, how many gold pieces did we get? How many experience did we get? Oh, I'm leveling up. There is none of that. This all happens during the game usually. So when you make that roll on your characteristics, if it's got a, it's going to go up right then. So I felt like it was a good opportunity to kind of maybe force that interaction to talk about what happened in the, in that campaign arc in game. And I thought that might be interesting to tell stories, say, oh yeah, you know, you're right. I actually, in that social conflict with Captain Elgor, he did something that made me uncomfortable, because they lost a social conflict. Well, I feel like that's going to make me feel ashamed. So I want to get rid of Homesteader now. That's not really what my characteristic is. That's not really part of my character. I'm past that. But I do have ashamed. And you can tap into negative aspects of your character just like you can positive aspects of your character. And I think real people do that all the time, because they learn through experiences. And now I can affect that within my character. And I honestly, I love the idea of the social conflict, because I've always wanted a game that did that. And I told you that's why I wrote this game. But through writing it, I realized that I believe character growth is a stronger concept of growth for your avatar or whatever it is, your character, your PC, then getting more hit points and then getting another spell that you can cast. I just love the idea of the broadness of, oh, my character is growing through play and this is how he advances. And it really does help you in the game. So it's a mechanic that works. It helps you in the game. Plus it better reflects that growth is my thought.
That's really fascinating. This has been a really cool conversation. It kind of blows my mind that nobody's really like done something like this before. I mean, in the 50 years of the hobby, you would think that somebody would have come up with more of like a social combat,
Ring, Burning Wheel, do it.
Okay.
But they're very, very, very complex and they're only in a very tight place where this is kind of, here's a very tiny rule. But instead of it being like a linear column of how you would use it in the game system, it's like it starts tiny and then it cones out to broad uses out throughout the whole game. You're always using it. You're always tapping.
Right.
You're always having it be an effect. You're always looking at it on your character sheet. But really, do you need it to look at it? It's five things about your character. You pretty much already know what they are.
Yeah.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to say I think it exists, but it doesn't exist like this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't know all of the different systems that exist. So obviously, I was probably like misspeaking in that sense. But so, I mean, I think it's good that you point that out. But I do feel like there's something, I can't really exactly put my finger on what it is, but I do feel like they're like everything ties, like all the systems seem to like tie into each other and have like a nice, you know, like I really love slot based inventory systems. I love the fact that, so like, I remember playing a 3E game, way back in the day where my character had like some kind of like weakness spell cast on them and it didn't really have an effect on the character per se. Right. But now it's like, you know, with the slot based inventory, it's like, well, now you have an actual resource that you can go, okay, well now your character just can't carry as much stuff. You know, and in addition, you have like status effects that are going to affect other aspects of, you know, regain, like you said, regaining the sand and all of that kind of stuff. Like, so I think it's really elegant about how you have such a, I don't want to like say it's simple.
It is.
But
no, it is.
But, simple. But you know, something, it just feels intuitive. It feels like you said, who's got time to read 300 pages? And you can get sitting down to play a game relatively quickly, especially when you got this character generator, which like blew my mind about how simple, like I was like, oh, I'm going to have to do, I just clicked one button and all of a sudden I was like, holy shit, I have a character here. Like this is, you know, like
you could even tell you the improvements we were going to make on the character generator because I got into it. I started to, like I say, there's a lot of things you have to erase and take control of.
Okay.
But back in the day, I didn't write my hit points on my character sheet. I had a note card that I would take care of my hit points. Right. So we thought, hey, why don't we have, because you can print right off of that character generator as well, which is on your mobile phone. Well, instead of just printing your character sheet, we're going to have a tracker that you can just print that tracker and then it's going to have the things. And so when that tracker gets used, then you apply that to your character sheet after the session.
Neat.
So that's one of the things we're going to add on to that. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
No, that's cool. No, that's actually
what we were thinking about.
I like that. So just to like, because we've been talking for a little while now.
I know we're over the time limit. I'm sorry.
No. We don't have a time limit on the Dungeon Plunger podcast. So being as like, I try to purport myself as trying to help game masters, new and old, what would be some advice that you would offer to new or veteran game masters?
I feel like I gave us some advice already, especially in a West Marches game and some thoughts. And you mentioned that you're going to ask me this question. And I was trying to, as I was talking, come up with what I would say. I used to always talk about a player GM versus a GM's GM. Like when you run a game, is that the game you would want to play? Do you like it? And so what I would say is, I've always said that I'm a GM's GM. You always say you're a player's GM. Like you're a huge fan of the players and I just want them to succeed. And I think that when I'm a player, I wish I had a player's GM versus a GM's GM compared to how I GM, which a lot of times, especially in Kalmata, where it's kind of rigid. Like I'm rolling everything in the open, nothing is hidden, and around every corner is fatality, really, or out of the game, or save or suck situations. But I've personally always been a fan of the characters. Hate the players, love the characters. It's something I used to say. But when I would say it's a social game, man, have fun and just do it. If you feel like you've ever wanted to publish something, it's so easy to do now. And it doesn't have to have a professional graphic artist, because you're not really publishing it for them. You're publishing it for you. And if one person, just like Random Screed, if one person enjoys it and feels like it was something that was good and gave them some value, then it was worth it. And it's always going to give you that worth and value. So why not?
Sound advice, man. I love it. All right. Well, I just want to really thank you for coming on the show, Mr. Hobbs. It's been a pleasure. And I definitely... Oh, go ahead.
I just wanted to add one last thing.
Yeah, man.
For all the people that listen and are fans of Weeb, as I am, stay alive. You got a job to do.
Oh, man. It's been a long time since we've heard that. And I wholeheartedly agree. I don't want to, you said it well, I don't want to ruin it, but yes. Yeah. So thanks very much for being on the show and for helping me plunge the dungeon this week and flush evil down the drain as always. And until next time, union members, plungers up. That's all for this week, folks. Music and stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener. It is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that Linguinion's Jason. If you want to hear more interviews like this one, follow us and share this podcast with your friends, your family, your neighbors, random strangers, the people living in the wall, the troll that lives under the bridge, the guardian of the lost city, everyone! It means the world to us that you share our podcast and make our numbers bigger. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.